dedicated to all the hackers and the crackers.
To the hackers and the crackers.
I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll sue you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISO? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. You see, G, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack.
This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial code, source codes, ISOs, RANs, SIPs, SIPs. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Binary Revolution Radio, episode number 167. I am Stank Dog with you again this week, and we are coming to you on the 3rd of October, 2006. Or whenever you actually downloaded this episode off of the podcast, or whatever you want to call it, vidcast, netcast, audiocast, radiocast, whatever your word of choice is all good with us. And joining me this week on the show is a returning co-host, and actually we'll turn this into an announcement on the show. Our newest DDP member, Verbal, is on the show with us. Welcome to the show, and welcome to DDP, Verbal.
Hey, thanks a lot. Good morning, Norway. How's it going over there? All right.
I can tell you how it's going. Cold.
Yeah, so I guess I'm in the DDP now. Thanks for Spank and all the other members for their support.
Thanks.
Much
for,
love.
Thanks for sending me the bag of money. I appreciate that.
Let's
do a little housekeeping. I'll let you go ahead and start off first. What kind of housekeeping stuff do you have?
Yeah, I just want to mention, last week I kind of ranted a little about the mentorship program, and I was saying that, you know, we didn't have enough mentors, and we had like 5-6 people that were still looking for someone, and, you know, people actually, you know, came up and emailed me and, you know, took up the spot to be a mentor, and now we only have like 2 people that are not mentored. So, you know, if you're out there listening and you feel like you have some, you know, something to contribute, then, you know, please feel free to give me an email. I just wanted to mention that. But the mentorship program is going really well, and I think people are enjoying themselves and learning a lot in the process.
Yeah, and I got to say, I'm really proud at how this has taken off because, you know, this is something I've been wanting to do for a while and didn't have the time really to dedicate to get it off the ground, and you've done a great job with it. But I really am surprised, in a good way, that so many people have volunteered to help out. It's exceeded my expectations already, and it's just getting started. So I really couldn't be more proud of the way this thing is getting started. And I know that we have a few things on our plate to help get this a little bit more organized. We're going to be putting up a website and have some tools and some things on there that will help both the mentors and the mentees. Am I correct with that?
Yeah, I mean, basically right now we're doing a little site that will make my life easier. Let people who are interested in participating send mail or sign, like, do a form directly to me and, you know, whoever's running the thing. So I don't have to sit there and manually, like, sort all the emails and stuff. And also we add, like, a wiki and some other facilities for, you know, different pairs of people who are mentoring to kind of exchange information with each other or just, you know, put whatever they're doing on a site, you know, on the internet somewhere so that other people who may not have time to participate or, you know, just for archival purposes in the future, like all that will be documented. So hopefully we'll kind of have like a flipbook or a scrapbook of all this stuff that, you know, hopefully other people in the future will be able to draw from.
Yeah, and it's that's really cool to be able to, also if like you're doing duplicate information, you know, you might be able to share some programs or some sample code and things like that, which is cool. You know what else I think is, I don't know if we've mentioned this before about the mentoring program, but something else that's kind of cool is don't overlook the possibility of mentoring someone at your local BenRev meetings or whatever meetings you have locally. If you could actually get together with someone once a month face-to-face and sit down and do stuff and demo stuff on a laptop, I mean, it's great doing it through email and through the global interweb and even phone calls if you're doing that. But still, sitting down with someone, you know, sometimes you just can't beat that. So if you actually are at a meeting, you know, don't feel afraid or don't be embarrassed or whatever to get together or go to a meeting if you know there's someone there that can mentor you, you know, and you've never been to a meeting before. By all means, go, because there is nothing but good things that can come out of it. So that face-to-face thing is something else that I don't know if we've mentioned, but it's certainly worth repeating if we have. Also in the housekeeping, and Verbal, maybe you can speak to this as well, but IRC is up and running. Is that right? We finally got that ironed out. We had a few little bugs here and there with the servers, but that's all ready to go, right? You can connect to irc.benrev.net.
Yeah, we had kind of an old setup that we were changing over to a new set of servers. So we kind of cut, because before we were at like a, you know, an intermediate state where we were using the old and the new servers, and some of the things weren't syncing up. But now we're completely moved over. You can just connect to irc.binrev.net, and it will connect you to an IRC server. And everything seems to be okay. The only thing, however, is I apologize that if you already had a NIC registered, you have to re-register again. But, I mean, this was probably as of last week. So if you're using IRC regularly, you know about this. But if you haven't, and you go and try to register your NIC, and it says your NIC's not registered, you're going to have to re-register again because we couldn't reuse the database, the services info. So for that, I apologize. But everything else, though, is going great, and everything's working.
Now, you've also, I know you were going to, and actually I probably should ask you this off the air, but we're up on this final IRC daemon that we're going to use, right? You were talking about switching. Is that, are we sticking with the one we have now, or are we going to, again, change in the future, which is going to require people to re-register again?
No, I think, you know, the IRC daemon we're using now is fine. You know, I haven't had any problems with it.
Okay.
Some people before was mentioning that they want to switch to Unreal, but to be honest, I don't really care, and, you know, the one we're using now works.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Right. I mean, like, don't fix it if it's not broke. So.
Exactly. All right, so, cool. Register your NICs, irc.benrev.net. All you'll have to remember is that one address. And the link, if you just click on it from the home page or any of the BenRev pages, it'll take you right to it, and it'll automatically pick one of the servers that are out there. So we are in the process of getting some good, steady, reliable servers up and running. And what the hell was that? Okay, one of my boxes on the other side of the room just came alive, so made a little noise. So sorry about that.
Exterminate.
It's like, you know what? I saw the preview for that Transformers movie, to go completely off topic, which looks badass, by the way.
Dude, that movie looks awesome.
You know, I don't want to turn this into a movie review show, but we got the Transformers movie coming up. We got the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles CGI coming up. It's going to be a badass year for movies next year, is all I'm saying. Anyway, back to the show. Oh, and I saw Jackass 2, which was hilarious. Anyway, with the new IRC daemon, if anybody has a good, reliable server, and what I mean by that is no cable modems, no DSL lines, no dynamic IP addresses of any kind, even if you have a persistent one, I don't want that, but if you've got a server out there, co-located, a dedicated server that you don't mind donating a little of the bandwidth, or just even as a backup, contact us and let us know, and we want to put a few more in there just in case something does happen to some of them. For the most part, what we have in place now is pretty doggone reliable, but it's always best to have more, especially as we grow. And speaking of growth, there are several channels that we have put out there, persistent channels. For example, we created #code, CODE, which has been really, really, even today, let's see, Monday afternoon, I got a lot of great information out there about a project I was working on, some questions I had, all code-based stuff. So we're kind of breaking stuff apart into different topical channels. There's a Pound Freaking channel out there, and we're working on putting together a complete list and kind of break things down by topic, because frankly, Pound BenRev, which is the main channel we've always used in the past, has grown so much, and you've got 50 people in there chatting about so many different things that it's pretty much a mess, and it makes it difficult to actually concentrate on one conversation or any productive conversation. So we're kind of breaking that down so that we're going to have a few official channels, and we'll put up a website with a little bit more information about those. And if you have an idea for a channel that you'd like to register, let us know. Especially what I was thinking of is like the BenRev meetings. If your local BR, like for my BR 407, maybe we'll make a persistent channel for that where we can get in there and plan about things we want to do at our upcoming meetings, or discuss when and where if we want to change meetings or different topics or what to bring, that sort of thing. So anything like that, or any other group of any kind. You got a website out there, other hacking websites, hacking shows. If you want to have an official IRC network and you don't already have one, by all means, contact us, and we'll see what we can do about that. And because, wow, we're taking more long time in housekeeping than I expected, but IRC is a good, I think that's a good, using the time to talk about IRC is a good thing. Quickly, I'll mention that Doc Droppers is finally back up and running. Thank you to people who emailed me and let me know it was down, but we were aware of it and didn't even have time, unfortunately, to put up a page saying, sorry, we're under construction. I've been so busy, but that is back up and running again. We were basically upgrading it to the latest version of MediaWiki and had a few problems with the database changed in the new version, so it kind of sort of worked, but it kind of sort of didn't. None of the login or authentication worked anymore. So we backed everything out. We're back to square one. We're still going to be upgrading it soon. We're just going to have to approach it a little bit differently. So right now it is back up and running. So if you want to go back out there and make some changes, additions, or comments or whatever to some of the content, by all means, feel free to do so. And we are going to try to pick it up a little bit and give time to our main topic that wrapped over from last week about IPv6. So let's do some email. All right, our first email. There I go again. I always say all right when I come in and out of a segment. I'm so bad at this. All right, our first email this week comes from Iron Geek, longtime friend of BenRev. Iron Geek says, hi guys, I'm guessing the second feature that Verbal is going to mention is mandatory implementation of IPsec. Your application does not have to use it, but my understanding is IPsec has to be implemented in an IPv6 stack to match the RFCs. In IP4, it's optional. A few things IPsec provides are, and this is a blatant copy and paste from Wikipedia, as he points out, 1, encrypting traffic, so it can't be read in transmission. 2, integrity validation, ensuring that traffic hasn't been modified along the path. 3, authenticating the peers, both ends are sure they are communicating with a trusted entity in the traffic entity the traffic is intended for, and 4, anti-replay, protect against session replay. Encryption on the network layer may slow some things down with the key exchange and all, but for some things it should help a lot with security. Thanks for the great show, guys. Iron Geek. As a side note, could you plug the upcoming Freaknik X convention, that's Freaknik 10, convention in Nashville. A whole lot of us BenRevers will be there and plan to meet up. So yes, absolutely, Iron Geek, consider Freaknik plugged. Go check out freaknik.info is the website, the only .info site that I know about, quite honestly. freaknik.info. So go check it out. They've got the speaker list up, including Iron Geek himself. I think several BenRevers. I think Low Tech is speaking there. Low Tech and Night Lord, I think, are co-presenting on something. My good friend Acidus is presenting on something that I know will be leet. Decius has got a couple presentations going on. Rattle is presenting. Lots of great people presenting some great stuff. So go check that out if you can make it to the Nashville area. Okay. As far as these other things, Verbal, do you want to... Should we hold off and do the... Because we are going to talk about these things, right?
Yeah, let's wait until later in the actual main topic, and then I'll kind of refer back a little bit, because I'm going to go over it anyway.
Yeah, because, you know, and last week, basically, we had a little technical glitch, so we had to chop the show into two portions, which is kind of threw off our timing. So we ended up spending a lot more time on covert channels and IPv4 a little bit than we should have. So last week's show was really about covert channels more than anything as a main topic. So this week we're going to catch up and do the IPv6 stuff. So we'll get to that in a few minutes. Zip through some more emails. Like this wonderful email. email from Tim, who says, quote, "Motherfucking ad. Fuck you, motherfuh. Let's go ride bikes." End quote. Now,
it's called the ADD. I don't know.
Is that what it is?
Ad works, too.
Motherfucking ADD. Okay, it is all caps. ADD, I guess that's attention deficit disorder. He's got it. That explains a lot. I have no... And the subject line of this mail was, "It's not sexy if we don't hear the zip." Which, of course, made me think that this is prawn spam, you know, which, of course, I opened. But there's no link. There was no link inside. Actually, I don't get a whole lot of spam on that account because I don't really... I mention it on the radio every single week, of course, but I don't actually post it on the interweb very much. So it doesn't get a whole lot of spam, but there was no link in it, and I'm not sure how to reply or whether I should reply to this email, so I guess I'll just say, Tim, thanks for the email, I guess?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
All right, well, let's go on to the next one, which came from Mike, which makes a little bit more sense here. Mike says, "Hey guys, great show. I was turned on to you guys by another great security podcast, Paul.com Security Weekly. Anyway, I just finished listening to episode 164, and you mentioned that Yahoo only uses SSL to transmit the rest of the session, then the rest of the session is unencrypted. By default, Gmail is the same way. However, if you type https://gmail.google.com, the entire session is encrypted. It would be better by default, but at least it's there. Great show. Keep up the good work." Now, I could have sworn that we mentioned that exact thing, that by default it didn't, but if you put in hard-coded that full path, because I thought even Iron Geek brought that up in an email, and we verified it on the air. Was that maybe an episode after that or something?
Well, it depends on when you got it, but the last episode, we definitely talked about it, because Iron Geek emailed us.
Oh,
he told
okay.
us, actually, his URL was https. mail.google.com. I don't know if gmail.google.com works, but I mean, one of those would work, both of them. But yeah, but I mean, it's cool just to rehash, because I think a lot of people don't really know about it,
right?
Because they just type in gmail.com and then they go. So
yeah, and this is probably a case of timing of the emails crossing. That's all. So that makes perfect sense. And you know, the reason they do this by default, too, is, and I just in case I didn't mention this, when you're encrypting everything, you're adding a little bit of overhead to every single packet. I mean, every single thing is encrypted, which adds, I mean, anytime you encrypt a file, it's going to usually get, even if it's just a little bit bigger, especially when you break it down packet by packet, it just increases the traffic. Now, when it's just you, it's not such a big deal. But I think I saw... Oh my gosh! I should have ripped it out of the magazine. How many users that, like, for example, Yahoo Mail has and Gmail has? So many users that adds up quicker than you might realize. So that's probably the reason they don't put it on by default, is because it just adds so much bandwidth. Although Google really doesn't, I don't think bandwidth is really a concern of theirs. But generally, when you're running your own server, that's always a concern or a point of knowledge, a point of attention. That. Anyway, and actually, Verbal, I'm going to throw this at you, by the way, because I'm not a fan of Gmail. I'm not a fan of Google, but that's a whole other side story. I actually logged into my Gmail account today to send an email to Verbal, and first time in a couple of months, probably, I really logged into it for any length. You know, I might have jumped on, sent something, and jumped off, but I actually got in there, looked, and my Gmail account, which, let me emphasize, I never use. I've never registered on a website with it. I've never posted it publicly, my Gmail account. If you go Google for my Gmail account, you won't find it. Yet somehow there are 1,117 messages in the spam folder. So somehow it's out there. So what do you think about that? Is Google selling these addresses out there? Because there's no way that I've released that anywhere.
No, I mean, Google is definitely not selling your information. Like, I know a lot of people who work there, and, I mean, I've had many conversations with those people, and they try very hard to not do creepy stuff. Like, if they wanted to, they can, you know, like, they have everything you do log, and if they wanted to, they can, like, do all sorts of, like, creepy shit to you.
I know.
But, I mean, they make it a point to try not to be evil. Now, like, a lot of people I've told that to, yeah, whatever, they have it. There's no reason why they wouldn't use it. Now, whether you believe that or not, you know, that's up to you. But from what I've seen, they try not to, you know, abuse the information they gather from you. Now, the other thing as to why, you know, you might be getting spam is that, like a lot of spam people, I think one of the things they do is they'll enumerate accounts. So let's say, what was the name of that Gmail account? Like, was it spankdog@gmail.com?
Yes, it was.
Right. So, you know, if I were a spammer, not that I am, but I would probably, you know, if I'm finding legitimate accounts, you know, from wherever, I would probably just try to send it to, you know, that username at gmail.com too. Because they probably have an account. Like, for example, my Gmail address is verbal@gmail.com. So maybe that's what's happening.
But like, how are they finding the account name?
You know, Google is putting it out there for other people to find, you know?
But how are they getting the account name even?
Well, I mean, you have other stankdog at accounts, right?
So you're saying that they know, they finding, for example, stankdog@stankdog.com, and they're saying, you know what, let's just go ahead and also send to stankdog@gmail and stankdog@yahoo and stankdog@hotmail and assume that he might have one or all three of them.
Probably. I mean, that's what I would do. I mean, it doesn't cost me anything. They just keep sending, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's not practical for me to enumerate the entire, you know, alphabet or, you know, the entire ASCII space, but, you know, if I know someone has that name, and they probably haven't. I mean, and you do, you know, like, and you do, and I do, and a lot of other people I know do. I mean, people like to keep one username for all their emails, you know?
Yeah.
That's just my hypothesis. I could be, I mean, I'm totally talking out of my ass, but that seems to make sense to me.
Well, the Hotmail, my Hotmail account is so overrun with spam that I never use that anymore. So if anybody's ever emailed me at that and I never responded, it's not because I'm a dick. It's because I don't use it anymore. It's dead. Or it might be because I'm a dick. One of the two things. Yahoo, don't have, and Gmail, have it, but barely ever use it. So,
Stankdog. Well, if you want, right, just get stankdog@yahoo.com and then see what comes in.
Yeah. It's probably, and actually there might, I don't know, it might be, maybe I have it, don't remember. I don't know what I've got anymore. I don't use it if I've got it, I'll say that.
All right.
Let's move on here. How about you take over some email for a minute and let me have a nice sip of my sweet iced tea.
Sweet iced tea. This is not so. Okay. Next email is from Jason. Jason writes, verbal. No, bang. Don't support the evil empire of Apple, period. They cheat developers. They misrepresent facts with their marketing. They are locking people into their products with DRM. They are unethical and a typical corporation exemplifying what is wrong in America and the world. For a buyer revolution person, why are you not supporting the OSS movement? Even if there are rough edges here and there that have not been addressed by developers quite yet. Well,
hold on. Let me defend you. Let me defend you real quick because there's a jump between the first paragraph and the second paragraph big time. Just because we had that little discussion about Apple, which I knew that was going to come back. I knew it was when I asked you the question. Very much we, and I think I'm speaking for verbal and I'm speaking for most hackers when I say this, very much support open source software. And we've always always supported open source software from the first episode of this show, even further back. I mean, we've always been big, big supporters of open source software and turn people on to open source software all the time. I don't think that's any way, shape, or form related to his first comments about Mac and Apple. Now, it just so happens I do kind of agree with some of his views on Apple, but you don't. So let's not... I'll defend you and say you're not supporting the open source software movement. So I'll step into that part. Now, I don't know if you wanted to follow up on the Apple part of it or not, but it's the floor is yours.
That's such a bittersweet defense you have.
I don't agree with you on Apple. I really don't.
In my own defense, now, the thing is, I do use, open source software. Obviously you don't know me that well, and that's to be expected, but OS X is not the only thing I run. Like, I try to use the correct tool for the correct purpose, and instead of just, picking one and then saying, okay, I'm going to use it for everything. So just to give, a brief overview, for example, I have, for my, firewalls, and if I'm, I used to have, a computer as a router, but now I don't. I have some Cisco box. But, for that stuff, I use OpenBSD because I like PF, and, I think I'm going to get shit for saying this, but I think OpenBSD is more secure by default than some of the other OSs, which I know is not really true to an extent, but with the way it's packaged and, compared to other distros, it's just kind of like a bare-bones thing, and it does what I want. And, I've been using it for a while, so that's just what I know for, if I want to use firewall or, some router. Now, if I want, personally, I like to use FreeBSD, actually back in, the 4X days, because 5X is kind of messed up, and I haven't really tried 6X yet. But, if I have a box that I want to use as, a server, then I would use FreeBSD. And, the problem with, this, picking which OS to use and stuff, kind of for me anyway, comes from the desktop. I've spent a ton of time trying to find a good desktop OS. And, long story short, ultimately I settled on OS X because it kind of gave me enough power to do everything I wanted, and it had the kind of code quality for the UI that I was looking for, you were mentioning about the rough edges, and it's also easy to use, and there are third-party, not open-source applications. Now, I have no problem with buying and paying for an application if it does what I want and it's reasonably priced.
Absolutely.
Right. So, for example, for GIMP or Adobe Photoshop or whatever, GIMP is a good replacement, but it doesn't compare to Photoshop at all. If you need to do some serious, photo editing and stuff like that,
you are
GIMP
so asking.
Does not compare.
You are so asking for hate mail.
Yeah, whatever. I don't care. I'm putting myself out there. Right?
I'm not disagreeing necessarily.
With all of Apple's shit, they make it products that I like. So to be honest, I don't really care if they're that evil. And I think, in my opinion, that they're less evil than some other vendors.
Google.
Woo! Yeah. I'm going to go duck now.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not saying I necessarily disagree with you. I'm just saying, we're going to catch hell for that one. I brought this up last week too. I mean I do like what I've seen, and I do have limited experience admittedly with OS X, and I threw out there the idea of OS X is great, but that doesn't justify the hardware that costs twice as much as the PC equivalent. That's my problem. It's more on the hardware end than anything. That's my personal problem. I think they overprice it. And you know what? Let's go on to the next email, because it's also related to this. So do you want to take this one since you're on a roll?
Yeah. Oh, actually, before I move on, it's kind of ironic. Oh, not ironic, but it's coincidental that this weekend I was at TorCon, and the new OS X 10.48 upgrade came out. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'm not doing anything. I'm just sitting here on the couch, so I upgraded. And after I upgraded, and this is not the first time that it's happened, the upgrade fucked up my NetInfo database, and I couldn't log in. And this was like Saturday.
Apple is so wonderful.
Yeah, and like this has happened before, and you know, you go online and you look, and it's like, yeah, if this happens, then follow these steps to rebuild your NetInfo database. Oh, and by the way, NetInfo is like what OS X uses for its like password stuff. It's basically an Etsy password, but with more info in it, and you can do more with it. But aside from that.
All right, you know, way to preach the...
I rebuild it, and it doesn't work. And for the whole weekend at Toracon, I couldn't log into my laptop. And, yeah, and...
Boy, this is a great...
I got home, and I just immediately reformatted.
This is a great...
And
there's
guess
more.
What I also did, while I was reformatting my laptop, I ordered a ThinkPad T60.
Yeah, you're really not doing a good job of pimping out how great the Mac is with stories like that, you know?
Whatever. I'm not pimping anything.
I'm just saying. You're not doing a good defense.
I use what I use. So I'm going to end up selling my MacBook, I think, and just using
the
60 for a while.
Yes. Oh, that was awesome. Anyway.
I still stand by everything I said about Apple.
Right, but you're going to sell it. Sure, okay. Why don't you read the next email? You're digging yourself so deep that I don't know if they make ladders that tall now.
Okay. The next email is from Zed Senthow. He says, I have a quick question for you. I've been involved in IT for many years now. As a service engineer, often install Windows networks and use the dreaded Microsoft apps and OS every day. But a few years ago, I decided to try out an Apple Mac and now would never use anything else at home. Not having to worry about viruses and spyware is a bonus when surfing dodgy sites, but the reliability of everything Mac just makes me sure that I'll stick with my Apple. On the odd occasion, I've heard it radio is more often than not disrespected. Why? Why not have a session on their radio about and eggs of owning a Mac and its uses or uselessness in the world of the hacker? Well, that's it for now. Take care and best wishes from South Wales in the UK.
All right. You kind of broke up on us there, so let me repeat just those last couple of sentences from this end, because I'm not sure if they came through, but it said... on the odd occasions I've heard anyone mention Mac on Ben Rev Radio, it's more often than not disrespected. And why? Why not have a session on Ben Rev Radio about the plus and negs of owning a Mac and its uses or uselessness in the world of the hacker? So that was really the gist of his email, shortened. I think we kind of just went into this, and I want to hurry up and get through this email, but I think Jason from the previous letter answered it pretty well from my standpoint, the proprietary. I can sum it up in one quick sentences, that it's proprietary, overpriced, underpowered hardware and software. That period, that simple. And actually, I'll even be willing to take out the software and just say proprietary, overpriced, underpowered hardware. That is my big beef with Apple. And you know what? That's just my opinion. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that as a business practice, as the way they want to do this. You want to make proprietary software? That's fine, but I'm not going to fall for this marketing bullshit and all these money they put into commercials and advertising, which is probably why they have to raise the price so much. But there's a reason they only have 5% of the PC market. They don't have the sales that IBM clones or PC clones or whatever you want to call it. IBM made the same mistake when the PC first came out. They tried to make proprietary hardware, and then all of a sudden Dell came out and Gateway came out and all these other companies came out and all these clones started, and they just blew them right away. They completely destroyed them in the PC market. Same thing happened then. Mac gets away with it because they have done some very innovative things. I will not take that away from them, but they just want too much control over it. They're trying to double dip on the hardware and the software and the digital rights management and the intellectual property and blah, 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 blah. I don't know. I think we've beaten it to death. I know that we've done episodes on Mac and Mac OS X and discussed it very early, like season one, season two. I'm pretty sure we had Logan Five on. We've talked about it. I'm certain we've beaten this topic to death. Cypher X, I know, was on, talked about it. So I don't know. I don't want to. I think we've already done enough on Mac for this episode. What do you think?
Yeah.
Let's.
I'm actually coming right now.
Alright, you sound completely like a fucking Transformer right now, so I'm going to pretend you didn't say anything, because I don't know what the hell you said anyway. And give you time to go open a window, hang your head out or something, and get a signal on that shitty phone of yours. And I'm going to go ahead and read this last email quickly. Can you hear me okay?
I can barely hear you.
Oh, your phone is the sucksor and you suck at the online. The last
email. I'm back.
All right, there you go.
I threw my head out the window, and I'm back.
All right, well, then you can you read the last email, or do you want me to?
No, I got it. I got
okay. this. He's hanging out the window on one leg.
The last email is from Gerald, or something. I can't read. It's okay. Well, first of all, I just wanted to say I love the show. I would like to recommend hackandmedia.org to your listeners who crave more shows like this one. I know that it is part of the DDP, but there might be a few listeners who don't know about it. Also, I want to recommend the Backtrack Live CD Distro for those who want to try out a few of the open source tools you guys covered. Backtrack is result of Wax and Auditor being combined and could be found at remote-exploit.org.
All right.
Definitely, like, HackerMedia.org is awesome, and if you don't know about it, you know, definitely check it out. They have a lot of shows, a lot of quality shows that if you enjoy this one, that you would probably like also. And also, thanks for talking about Backtrack. I mean, I've used Backtrack and Auditor, and, you know, they're both actually very quality live distro CDs for doing pen testing and all that stuff. Definitely check it out if you want to play around with, just running some tools and seeing how they work.
Yep, good stuff. I mean, we've definitely mentioned all of those sites on the show before. Also, not only hackermedia.org, but if you like this type of show, check out ddphackradio.org, which is a streaming radio station 24/7, playing reruns of BinRev Radio, playing a lot of other great shows. A scheduling list is on the front page of that, so if you want to sit and listen at work and things like that, in your headphones, of course, because I like to drop the F-bomb for those who don't already know. Definitely worth repeating and mentioning them. Now, we are going to go into our main topic. We've got about, 40 minutes total left, so let's try to quickly go over IPv4. Enough to, because we need to set the table a little bit before we go into IPv6. As much as we'd like to dive into it, we do need to talk about IPv4. So I want to briefly, just a few minutes, go through at least some of the main points that are going to come into play again in IPv6. Specifically, like the class ABCD address structure that's in place. With IPv4, you have the four octets of numbers that we're all used to in your address, and class A is anything with that first number, for example, 117.x.x.x, which is a class A address that means you have 117.0.0.1 all the way through 117.255.255.255, for example. That's important because basically what you realize is with a class A address, you have the flexibility of three different numbers in there, which gives you a huge number of IP addresses available to you. So Class A addresses are reserved for large backbone providers, large ISPs, usually big telcos. Any other examples you can think of Class A addresses? Universities, maybe. I don't even think universities really get them, do they?
No, like Class A is reserved for people with the money and power and, you know, who are around enough, long ago enough to reserve them. I mean, you really can't get in the class A anymore, but like the military probably has some, and
good point. Yeah, good point. I didn't think military government's probably got some of them. And, you know, if they show a reason, a lot of them were assigned earlier, right, but some of them have been reassigned and stuff. If you show a reason that you need, like, for example, let's say, I don't know, Bell South, again, for example, they may have Class A. I'm not sure if they do or not. If somebody can confirm that, by all means, email us. But they may have a Class A address because it's known that they have a lot of users, business and residential, that they're going to need a lot of IP addresses so they can justify getting a Class A address assigned to them or approved for them. And as you go down through those classes of address, B would be a fixed first node. Their first octet would be, say, 176 dot, and then you'll get one class second node assigned to you, like 180. I don't know. I'm making up numbers, which I hope I don't accidentally use a reserved one as an idiot. .x.x. So you don't have as many as a Class A, but you still have a large block. And I've worked for places that have had Class B addresses before. You still get a lot of freaking addresses on there. And anyway, to summarize, the further you go down there, Class C has even fewer addresses, and so on and so forth. So I think keep that in mind, because that is one of the problems with IPv4, is you have a limited number. You have those four octets. It's a 32-bit address range, which means you can only have numbers up to a certain size, certain length, 255. And because of that, you're limited to about 4.2, 4.3 billion possible addresses. And I kind of made one metaphor to phone numbers last week as far as routing, and we're not going to talk about routing too much here on IPv4, but another similarity to phone numbers is how we run out of unique phone numbers as cities begin to grow, and they end up having to branch off and create a new area code within a city as it grows because they've run out of unique numbers to assign to people for phone numbers, and they begin reusing them and things like that. So it's a similar problem. You have a limited number of unique numbers that you can use, whether it's phone number or IPv4 IP addresses. So that is one of the, and probably the primary driver. That's an opinion, but I mean, would you agree that's the primary reason that the push to IPv6 is really getting pushed?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. At least initially, because everyone's been complaining about, you know, like, oh, we're going to run out of addresses, you know, in like 2 years. They were saying that in like 98 or whatever. But now that, you know, people are using NAT, then that's not really kind of an argument anymore. But, you know, there are some other stuff. But that was definitely, I think, one of the main motivations.
Well, and that,
like, because the thing is, you know, if you see like, oh, okay, 32 bits is what, like 4.2 billion. And like, that's, you know, that's not that much, but it's still decent. But keep in mind that a lot of those you can't use, you know. Like, a lot of those ranges are reserved for stuff. And also, you end up with, you know, no matter what you do, really, you end up with a fragmentation. So, like, let's say you give an ISP a Class A, right?
Right.
They're not going to have they're not going to have every single one of those being used, because, you know, they're going to save some future customers, or they just, you know, have a Class A and they're just sitting on it. So that means other people can't use those possible available addresses. So, you know, a lot of fragmentation goes there. And then when you get to Class B, you end up, you know, so Class A is like, what, 16 million? And like Class B, you jump from 16 million to like 65,000. So, you know, you lose a lot just, you know, by jumping from Class A to B.
Right.
And there aren't that many Class A addresses. Family, so.
And you mentioned NAT, which is, so basically the primary driving reason, in my opinion, is the sheer number, the limit, because NAT is a temporary solution in that you are assigning internal addresses behind the scenes and letting your own equipment route everything to one IP address that you get assigned by your ISP, for example, and that way you don't need a unique IP address for each machine internally to your network. You let your own equipment handle all that switching, and you don't need to have a unique IP address for each one of them. However, wouldn't it be nice if you did? And yes, so it's a temporary solution, and it does get the job done for like browsing the web and things like that, but it makes it a little bit tougher if you wanted to set up a server inside of there. You'd have to do a whole lot of port redirection and lots of messy things. They work, but they're just not ideal. They're fixes. They're patches is what they are. They're just quick fixes to get a goal accomplished. So switching to switching from IPv4 to IPv6 will change from a 32-bit to 128-bit, and I'm going to let you talk more about this because I am not that well-versed. I'm very limited in my knowledge of IPv6 yet because it's still in the process of rolling out. But it gives you a lot more addresses, which is the primary reason, but there's also a lot of others, and even Iron Geek referred to some of them in the email earlier that you're going to talk about as well. So I think that's good on recapping IPv4. I think we've got the main points of that down, unless there's anything you wanted to add to that, and kind of move into IPv6. We've got
IPv6, I'm kind of trying to just quickly go over all the stuff that I did last time so I don't, you know, do the same show twice.
Right, well, let me tell you here, we've got, let's see, we're about approximately 45 minutes into the show. So we've got a good 30 minutes or so to dedicate to this.
Okay, so, cool. In that case, actually, let me back up a second, and let me rant about NAT a little bit. I don't know if, you know, how much of this did last show, but, you know, Sank, you mentioned that, you know, NAT is like a temporary solution and a patch and whatever, but the problem is people who are in support of NAT for you know, their own reasons, are kind of touting it as a new, like, feature, you know, like, not a quick fix. It's not, like, you know, to extend the usage of address spaces, and they're kind of, like, giving that, like, some benefits and saying, like, oh, we actually want this. And one of the things I went through about last time is, you know, is better security. And, you know, to me, like, that makes no sense, because why don't you, you know, use a firewall or something? Because if you have NAT, and hosts, you know, so that basically if you have a NAT, you can't have outside connections coming into boxes behind the NAT without specific port forwarding being set up on the box that's doing the NAT. But, I mean, you know, that sort of hiding doesn't really do anything. You know, it's one of those security through obscurity things.
Right, but, it doesn't hurt. So, it's not a bad thing, but certainly don't rely on that as the sole method of security.
Right, but the thing I want to stress is you're breaking the internet. Like, the internet, you are breaking the motherfucking internet. Like I was saying last time, you know, the people who designed the thing and all of the, you know, the way that protocols are set up and the stack is set up, you're supposed to have end-to-end connectivity. And if you don't, you're making this, like, little wee-wee version of the internet that does, you know, where a lot of things don't work and you have to spend the manpower to fix it. Like, so at school, I actually did research for the guy who invented that. His name is Paul Francis. And you know, we used, in class and, like, wherever I see him, we just have these, like, long arguments over V6, like, versus NAT. And, you know, and obviously he's going to like it because he invented it, but a lot of people share his point of view in which, you know, which is saying, like, oh, NAT is great for reasons A, B, C, and D. But then, you know, we don't care that it doesn't work and it breaks stuff. We'll just spend our grant money, you know, and our research time to, like, work around those and, you know, so we can publish more papers to get around those when you can actually be doing something else interesting.
Right.
Now, having said that, though, nothing prevents you from using NAT in V6.
Right, I was getting ready to ask that.
You can still use NAT.
Yeah, I was getting ready to ask that very question. First of all, NAT is kind of cool in what it does. Don't get me wrong. It is a cool solution to the problem, but it's certainly no reason to say, let's just stick with that and not move to IPv6. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. NAT is a cool solution. I do like it, but it does have limitations. And that's assuming, first of all, A, that's putting the burden of hardware on the consumer to have to buy and maintain and deal with their own stuff. And not everybody can do that, has the ability to set that up in their house and do their own NAT, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I do it, and a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, do it, but you don't expect your grandmother to do that. And, you know, as we change and evolve and have these new products coming up, more things want or need, or I should say will excel in having their own dedicated IP address that you don't have to worry about configuring and setting up an internal network and whatnot. And, I mean, just cell phones and other things are just touching the surface I mean, there's so many things that if we have unique addresses, and we talked last week about some of the math of how many 50 octillion addresses or whatever we came to the conclusion, we can assign address to everything, and you don't have to worry about all the maintenance and the hardware and the manpower, the hours that go into it, or woman power, as if there's any women listening to the show, but we won't rehash that topic anymore, what a sausage party this show is. You know, I understand and support NAT for a solution to the problem at hand, but there's no way that I could ever defend that to say let's not move to IPv6 because we've got NAT. That, to me, is just ludicrous.
Yeah, I mean, see, the thing is, not everyone is saying, like, well, okay, we understand there are limitations to V4, but V6 sucks a lot, too, so we don't want to move to it. But, you know, that's another point of view, and it's like, you might be right, I think that it's good enough, and it'll, like, kind of be, like, the better of two evils, so to speak, you know? Mm-hmm. But anyway, let's move on to more technical stuff instead of me just ranting about random shit.
Well, actually, there was one, you kind of brought this question up, and I don't know if we answered it or if you finished on it, but you were saying that you can still use NAT in IPv6, correct?
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely. I mean, all NAT is just a multiplexing and demux thing where you keep track, you know, you have hosts all sending, you know, you have a separate network, and basically multiplex that network's traffic from one box, and you just, like, use the ports as the way to identify, you know, to identify which box that's NATed behind you is using which connection. So, I mean, if all NAT does is multiplex your traffic, and you're using ports to identify which box is behind you in the internal traffic, in the internal network, are, you know, are matched with what connections are going out. I mean, and it has nothing to do with V4 and V6. You can use it in the new V6, and it'll work the same way. So if you
right.
want to use NAT for security, I mean, go right ahead. But if your grandmother tries to send you, you know, a picture of her cat's birthday party or whatever, then you might not be able to get it because you're behind a NAT.
I love pictures of cat birthday parties, by the way. I love them.
Cat birthday parties?
Yeah, good. That's a good point. But also at the same time, because you have so many addresses, you really don't need NAT, ironically. Sure, if you wanted, you could probably still do it, but you really wouldn't need it. So let's focus on some of the specific IPv6 features, I guess, if you will. Is that probably the next direction we want to take? We probably got, like, what, 20-some minutes left?
Yeah, let's go for it. So let's now take the chance to touch back on what Iron Geek was saying. He was mentioning that IPsec is mandatory in IPv6 now.
Well, what is IPsec? Back up. What is IPsec?
IPsec is an encryption layer for layer 3. So if you listen to the tunneling episode that we did, I mentioned that IPsec was one of the ways you can use to, you know, to do VPN.
Right.
So IPsec is just an encryption protocol for layer 3. So now, you know, so it's not, okay, so I think everyone's familiar with SSL. SSL is not a layer 3, and if you're, you know, looking at the SSL traffic, you can tell where it's coming to and from, like the source and destination IPs.
Right.
But with IPsec, it's kind of one layer lower, so you actually, you know, don't know where traffic's going to and from. And so the point is that IPsec is mandatory when you implement the V6 stack on, like, a host or a router, right? You don't have to use it, but it's mandatory in the host stack according to the RFC.
Okay.
And, you know, they're saying if you use IPsec or if you use SSL, then you're going to have, you know, an overhead. But since that service is always there, it's just going to make things easier for people to, you know, to implement IPsec in their protocols and in their applications.
All right.
Right. So So, I mean, you know, so that's what people mean when they say, like, oh, you know, V6 is more secure because it has IPsec. And then, you know, immediately some other people are like, wait a minute, well, you can do IPsec in V4, so what do you mean? And all they mean is just that the RFC says you must implement this. So no matter which V6 stack you're using, IPsec will be there and you don't have to install anything else.
Right, so it's part of the standard.
Right.
It is required. Okay. So that's all fine and dandy. But, and actually, I kind of have I had a question pop into my head. I'm going to go ahead and ask it. Hopefully, it doesn't take too long. With IPsec, does that make it more difficult to intercept? Well, I'm not even sure how to phrase it. We all know that the government, we know what Tor does and how it protects the packet's destination, source to destination, by handing them off so many times. It makes it difficult to trace something back. Is IPsec going to function similarly, not as far as using onion routing per se, but will it have a kind of a similar effect in that someone anywhere in the middle would be able to pick that up? They wouldn't know who the originating requester was or the site that they're requesting is, or am I way off base here?
Well, I mean, yes and no. Let's say, you know, I make an IPsec connection from like point A to point B. You can figure out relatively easily, you know, you can figure out, like, who's talking, but you don't exactly, you know, like, it depends on my amount of work, and I really don't want to get too much into it because it's not a show about IPsec.
Mm-hmm.
But the important thing is that if you use IPsec, people can't do man-in-the-middle attacks and replay attacks because layer 3 is encrypted. Well, I mean, that's not the only reason, but, you know, layer 3 and up are encrypted, so people are not going to be able to replay your packets, and they're not going to be able to do a man-in-the-middle.
So it's really to prevent forgery more than anything.
Right.
Okay. All right.
So you're not going to be anonymous.
Right.
So it's not going to be like Tor, where supposedly you're anonymous.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. All right, what else? What else is it bringing?
Sorry?
What else is IPv6 bringing?
Right. So one of the other big things is, you know, they want it to be easy to use. So they have this new concept called stateless auto configuration. Now, in V4, if you want to, so the method that you get an IP is you can configure statically, or you can use DHCP, and I think most of our listeners are familiar with that.
Right.
And DHCP, just to quickly go over, is you send out a broadcast request, and there's a router or DHCP server on your LAN segment that is responsible for giving you IP. And you send out a request, and then you get an IP back. And, you know, there are also some other fields, but that's kind of like the default setup right now. Now, in V6, you don't need to have a server sitting there listening to requests and then handing out IPs. They have, what you do is, a host is going to send a link local multicast request for configuration information. And now, if the router, like the first hop router, supports it, and it should because it's in the RFC, it's going to reply with a router advertisement, you know, that has the network layer configuration for the host. Now, so the good thing, I mean, it's pretty obvious that you don't have to run a separate application-level server to do this, and your router will automatically do this. So if, you know, your Joe Blow, like, V6 Linksys router or whatever will have this supported, then it doesn't have to implement DHCP. Now, having said that, DHCP V6 also exists. And, you know, some people might be like, well, why do you have DHCP? You have, you know, that link local multicast thing that you can do to get an IP. Now, DHCP has more features. You don't just get an IP. You can specify, like, you know, permission stuff and, like, lease times and all this junk. But, you know, it just depends on what you want. But basically, you don't have to use it if you don't want to.
I was going to say, I mean, this is kind of like NAT. It can still exist, but is there really a need for it?
Right. I mean, to be honest, I don't really know. You know, we would probably be better off to ask someone who works in IT, who has to, like, deal with this stuff on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, he or she can tell us, like, you know, if there are any advantages of using DHCP now that you have auto configuration things in place.
Right. I'm not sure I see it there, but, and I don't know that, the thing is, well, I don't want to interrupt you. I've got a lot of questions I could throw at you, so I'll let you keep going, and you give me a sign when you're done, and I'll throw I got a bunch of questions for you.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. So, just more things, more features for IPv6 is you get jumbo frame, and that means that your payload can be larger than 64 kilobytes. I mean, that's a good thing just because you get to send more traffic per packet, so that means that over time your header overhead will be less. Now this actually depends on each hop. Now if I send, you know, it's just like the MTU right now. If I send a packet from A to B, the MTU is going to be that of the smallest MTU per link on the way. So if you have jumbo frames, you need every single hop from A to B to support that, else, you know, your packet can only be as big as the smallest link without, you know, chopping it up.
Right.
So hopefully the ISPs and stuff will support this, so people can, you know, get bigger pipes at home and also benefit from it by having bigger packets.
Well, now, but if we step back, you know, and if you apply networking theory, the larger the packet size, theoretically, you increase the chance of having bad or corrupted data in that packet because you've got more data, so you have a higher chance of it being corrupted. How is that a negligible amount then that probably won't make, I mean, it's still so unlikely that it's not an issue?
Well, no, I mean, you have a CRC, right?
Right.
So if you get, you know, so if there's something wrong with your packet, you can correct it. You can correct it anyway. And also, so from the math point of view, I think your rate of, like, having a bad packet and having to resend. So what you're saying is if the packets are bigger and one of those packets, you know, have an error in it and I have to resend, then, you know, that's just, like, a waste. But the thing is, I think if you take the percentage of bad packets that have to be retransmitted compared to the overhead of the headers that you save by making the packets bigger, I think you're going to come out on top.
That's a good point, too, yeah. So even if it, I would suspect that it's just a negligible amount anyway, but yeah, that's a definite point. The savings that you would get from the overhead of the headers would more than make up for it, even if there is a small increase. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
All right, so let me keep going then. Okay, so if you actually look at, like, a diagram of the header, you'll notice that the V6 header has less individual fields than the V4 header. So what they kind of did was they tried to clean house a little bit. V4, there are a bunch of stuff that people don't really use, and it's just there for either historical purposes or, you know, they put in there so someone can have a covert channel or whatever. But in V6, they kind of look to see, okay, now that we've been using the internet for like 20-something years, you know, we can see what fields people actually use in the header. So, for example, one of these things is the type of service bits. And the type of service bit, it's supposed to be for QoS. But realistically, in the wild, not too many routers pay attention to it. So it's kind of a useless field. And, you know, it ends up being like other protocols kind of hack it and use those fields because it knows no one will kind of view it, so they'll use it for their own purposes and all this stuff. So in V6, they kind of, you know, fix that a little bit. And if, you know, so right now, actually, I'll go into the packet header format a little bit.
Okay.
Now, you have the version, which is in V4, it's the version field, and in IPv6, you have the same thing as IP version. And then you have the traffic class, which is 8 bits And that used to be the packet priority in E4. So that's pretty much the same. Now, one of the new things is the QoS bits that you have, the types of service that I mentioned. They're now kind of called flow labels, and it's 20 bits.
I'm sorry, you broke up right there. What was that again? That you were talking about the QoS, which is the quality of service.
Right. So in V4, have the TOS bits, the types of service bits that I was saying no one uses, right?
Okay.
Now, in V6, you have a flow label, which is 20 bits. Now, the flow label is designed to be heavily used, so, you know, the applications and the network layer is going to actively use the flow label to identify different types of flows. Now, when I say flow, I mean a whole kind of session of traffic. So if you have, like, an AIM session going on, like, that would be a flow. If you have an IRC session going on, that would be a flow.
Okay.
So it can separate out each kind of, like, application for you.
Got you.
Right. Now, the payload length is 16 bits. Now, that is 64K in standard mode. Or if you have jumbo packet support, then it will be bigger than that. Now, if you're using jumbo mode, then the payload length is going to have something that basically refers you to the IP header options, so you can have, like, a bigger number in there. And then you also have some of the same things, like the hop limit, which is 8 bits, and it does the same thing as the TTL field, and that's in V4. And you have the 128-bit source address and destination address. Now, one of the things that are different in a bad way, in my opinion, is that you have a next header kind of pointer. So now, in V4, you have the header, and, like, that's it. And that's the structure. And if we look at the network code, if that structure is in place and it's, like, you know, a C struct, and when you get a packet in, you just kind of cast that packet header onto the struct and everything is good. But in V6, what you do is you have an 8-bit next header field, and that points to the transport layer protocol. And the whole thing, the whole header in V6 works like this. You have a header, and at the end you have a next header pointer, which tells you where the next header is. And if you do this in code, what ends up happening is your implementation is going to be much slower because you have to deal with pointers, and you can't just, like, cast a struct onto the data that you get and start using it.
Wow, that's, I'm not sure if that's translating over to radio very well, but that's kind of deep.
Well, okay, so, I mean, basically, think of the V6 header as now being a linked list. Before, it was an array of a specific link, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now, so if you have an array of a specific length, like N, you know where everything is supposed to be, and if you say, want this field, then you can just go to that offset and access it, right? Easy.
Mm-hmm.
But now, the V6 packet header is a linked list. So if you want a specific field, you can't just go to some offset because basically the header can be a variable length. So you have to traverse the header and follow the pointers and then get to the correct section and then access the field.
Yeah, I'm sure our listeners that have some experience in OOP and object-oriented programming are probably familiar with linked lists and some of these terms, but
You're a fucking moron?
Huh?
But you're a fucking moron?
I'm a fucking moron, of course, so... Well, I don't know, maybe we should kind of wind this down a little bit. There's so much... I can't believe, again, that, I mean, I almost feel like there's, how much more, do you have much more you wanted to talk about? I mean, I could see this going into 2 or 3 more episodes if we're not careful about it.
No, I actually only have about 5 minutes of stuff.
Okay, well, let's,
so I'll just wrap it up.
Yeah, let's keep going. You got it, I think we've got about 5 or so minutes. I think we're okay.
Okay. Okay, so I just want to talk about address scope a little bit. There's 3 unicast scopes. You have global, site local, and link local. Now, the site local addresses is your, basically your non-link local addresses, which are valid within your scope of a site, in quotes, and you can't export, you know, beyond your site. So I guess that's like your private site, you know, not private as in like, you know, 192.168, but private as in it's supposed to be just your site. Now, the link local addresses, logically, you know, therefore, you know, those things that are you're connected to on the same hub or switch, right? Like your local LAN. So, like, things you can get from one hub. And then finally, your site local is basically your network. So they split it up like that, and, you know, it's not too important, but that's just how they do it. And lastly, you have V6, right? So the main thing to think about is how you're going to switch over. Now,
right now
at this moment, you can go and use IPv6 in your home network. But what you're going to have to do is tunnel over V4. So you have V6 traffic stuck in a V4 packet and sent over the internet to another site that supports V6. So the options very quickly are having a dual stack, which means you have one network stack that implements V6 and V4 that share a lot of the, you know, common parsing code, but just the different parts, you know, that need to be different are. And I don't actually have an example of this because I don't know, you know, if people are implementing this, because I think they just do two for, like, for simplicity. Now, you can do tunneling, which is what I was mentioning, you know, which is the encapsulation, and you have to, like, find a way to know where to send it. So now there are these, like, so, broker services. You can connect to them directly, and you can pay them to send, you know, to send these things for you to, like, they know where the V6 addresses are on the other side. So they'll do the encapsulation for you. Now, there are other automatic routing, tunneling techniques you can use, like the SixPhone exists, where it's like people themselves run a bunch of servers. So you have these little islands of V6, and you kind of do the routing yourself, and you, like, pass routes around and stuff.
Right, well, when this goes wide scale, to kind of wrap this up, basically what's going to happen is we're going to turn the interweb off for a day, right? And then come up the next day on IPv6? Is that how isn't that what we're doing?
Yeah, pretty much. No one used the internet on January 2nd, 2010.
Okay, mark your calendars. That's the day that the switchover will happen.
Yeah, so I mean, like, Japan and China, and other people who kind of are sick of the U.S. owning the internet. One of their motivations is, like, you know, we want to control our own internet, so we're going to switch to V6 and screw you guys. We're going home, and we're going to have our own backbone.
Screw you
so
guys.
All over it.
All right, well, I think unless there's anything else you got to spit out quickly, that's going to probably take us into the closing. Actually, we've got maybe 1 or 2 minutes. Can I ask a couple quick questions, or did you...
Yeah, no, go for it.
Well, one thing that immediately comes to mind to me that I can see being hella annoying is that right now it's easy to remember or memorize your IP addresses. It's 4 numbers, and we know the ranges of the numbers up to 255, the highest number. It makes it easy to memorize, jot them down, et cetera, et cetera. Isn't it going to be a pain with IPv6 trying to memorize your IP address, which is like EF8A-JJ7Q, you know what I mean. Isn't it going to be a little bit more of a hassle for that?
So, first of all, hopefully if things are implemented in a way where you don't have to remember IP addresses, because, I mean, most people nowadays, they're not geeks and not hackers, They don't know, like, the IP addresses and stuff. They just use DNS. And hopefully, you know, that trend will continue and grow as the addresses become more, you know, unwieldy. But having said that, though, you don't really need to remember the whole address. It's broken up in such a way that you can remember, like, the address of a site, and then you can, you know,
There is a method.
Address of like a host, so you can do it in a hierarchical way.
Right, there is a method to it, and we'll have to put that up on the website or something because we're running low. But there is a breakdown that says this first part of the address. Well, I narrow it down to a certain part, and then the second part of the there is some method to that. There is a naming convention for that.
If you want to know more specifics, just freaking go read the Wikipedia article.
They're at the stage now. Hopefully from listening to this episode, everyone should be on the stage now where if you do go read that, you might actually understand a lot more of it than when before the show started. I know I will for sure. So let's close out the show for this week. I think we did cover just about everything. It was still a lot of information to force into one episode. But I think we got through everything pretty well this time. Enough that, again, people can take it from here and go do their own research. If there are any questions, of course, they can email us, radio@binrev.com, any kind of feedback on this or any of the episodes of the show. Site of the week this week is something actually I picked up in the BinRev IRC channel. It's a program. It's called, the site is feedjournal.com, FEEDJOURNAL.com. It's kind of a neat little thing. I don't know why somebody hadn't thought of it before, that will take RSS feeds from multiple sources and generate a PDF file that is basically looks like a newspaper that you can actually print off and make a newspaper out of it, which is kind of funny because when I see people reading the paper, my joke is always, hey, a newspaper, isn't that like printing the internet, basically. So, actually, I guess now you can print the internet and make it a newspaper, so it comes full circle. So that's kind of a neat program. Closing music this week is, actually, it's the current song fight as we're airing this episode. It's this track is called You Get the Wiser. It's this particular version is from Mr. Man and Dr. Funk. I don't know who wins or if they'll win, so it'll be interesting to see if the one that I liked or picked ends up winning or not, but it's a nice song to end with because, actually, we're not going to do any shouts tonight because I kind of want to bypass this, and I'm sorry, Verbal, if you had any shouts, we'll put them off, but I'd rather skip it because I kind of have some sad news to close the show with this week. I got to pass on my condolences to the family of Lilo or Lilo, however you want to pronounce it. I actually know his real name. I've spoken to him on the phone before, but he's the guy who's running the Freenode IRC servers. We've dealt with him in the past. BinRev was actually on Freenode for a while until we had some people come in there, stir up a little trouble, and that's actually how I met and spoke to him before. And he unfortunately passed away a couple of weeks ago, as I found out, and not in a very bad way, unfortunately, a hit and run, which is not cool at all. So instead of giving shouts out, I just want to pass my condolences on to him. And anybody who's ever met him knows that he was really trying to make Freenode into something different than what traditionally IRC has been, with all the chaos and the problems and everything. So somebody who was really driven to make change and do something good. So my condolences go out to him, and sorry to end on such a sad note for this week, but Verbal, thank you for doing the show again this week. I think we did cover a lot of good topics, and again, got people started on the subject, so I think that is going to do it for this week. Welcome to the DDP, my friend, and let's tell everybody that we will see them next week, same hack time,
same hack channel.
When you're old, feeling like you're dead, with wrinkles on your head, don't think about me.